goal is to stop this leak once and for all and live up to the obligation we have to clean it up.
Shell works to limit the damage from an oil spill in the North Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 16th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the village of Chivac is offsetting some of its diesel needs with wind.
Chivac has saved about 50,000 gallons of diesel, so it's pretty good for, you know, trying to figure out the system.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Check the status of your application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for placing half in a college savings account and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Shell is working to contain an oil spill from one of its pipelines in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland. The crew on an oil platform there first observed a light sheen in the water last Wednesday. Around 1,300 barrels of oil have spilled so far into the sea. The company was able to shut down the main leak, but oil is still flowing from a small valve at the rate of about one barrel of oil per day. Curtis Smith is a spokesperson for the company in Alaska.
They're very close to moving, from what I understand, the marine debris in the way, some vegetation, so that they can access this final leak point and shut in this this portion of the pipeline.
The company is hoping to drill several exploration wells in the Arctic Ocean this summer. The federal government gave conditional approval earlier this month to Shell's plan to drill in the Beaufort Sea. But environmental groups have been critical of the plan, saying Shell isn't ready to clean up a potential oil spill in icy Arctic waters. Rebecca Noblin with the Center for Biological Diversity says the company isn't doing an adequate job cleaning up the North Sea spill.
We already have ample evidence that Shell shouldn't be drilling in the Arctic. Shell's oil spill plan isn't realistic, and it doesn't comply with the law. We already think that the Obama administration should deny its permits to drill in the Arctic. This North Sea oil spill just adds further evidence to, you know, the idea that drilling isn't safe, and that when something goes wrong, Shell isn't necessarily going to respond to it in the way that they said that they would.
Shell says the impact to wildlife from the spilled oil in the North Sea has been minimal, and the company points out its Arctic Ocean wells are nothing like the production well that is leaking in the North Sea. Smith says the company is confident it can operate safely in Alaska.
Any spill of any size is something that we take very seriously, and this leak in the North Sea is very regrettable. Our goal is to stop this leak once and for all and live up to the obligation we have to clean it up.
Smith says he can't speculate on when the oil spill in the North Sea will be contained. TransCanada, the state's license holder for a large-capacity natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to North American markets, told a legislative committee today that the state is partially responsible for the lack of potential gas shippers willing to sign contracts to use the project. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Legislators meeting this week in Anchorage are looking at the state's long-term energy future, particularly gas supplies that will become available for the Rail Belt and South Central. They're finding that the high-volume TransCanada project has no customers yet, and lawmakers are giving serious consideration to shifting their support to a lower-capacity bullet line. TransCanada is a year behind its original expectations on commercial negotiations, and it's prohibited from discussing details of the arrangements that have been made by confidentiality agreements. However, TransCanada Vice President Tony Palmer told the Senate Resources Committee that decision makers among the gas suppliers face three unresolved issues: gas supply uncertainty, such as availability of gas from the Point Thompson field, a state gas tax system that's unlikely to change, and better pricing projections for the world marketplace. Of those, the first two need the state's attention.
When we obtained the license 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, we'd assumed that Point Thompson and fiscal would be resolved between the state and the producers by the time our open season was concluded a year ago. That's turned out to be wrong. That was our assumption. That was nothing more than that. I'm not suggesting you were obliged to do that, but that was our assumption. We thought that in 2 years those things would be resolved. They have not been.
Palmer said that if those involved in the project are not optimistic the supply and tax issues will coalesce, TransCanada would have reached what he called a decision point on the continuation of the project. However, he said he's still holding out hope for a positive resolution.
If there continues to be optimism that they will be resolved in a timely fashion, then we're going to let the game play out, I would suggest to you.
Palmer did not hang possible shippers' decisions entirely on the state. He said there's no reason to have a supply or fiscal solution if companies believe market prices will remain at $3, as they now are.
You may find yourself having resolved these issues with producers and still have no project. That's not where we are today. We think that resolution will finally reach a conclusion, and we remain optimistic that this can occur. But I can't pinpoint one or the other. Now, if gas prices were $10 and it were guaranteed they were going to be $10 forevermore in North America or Asia, perhaps you don't need to resolve these issues. But they're not there today.
Palmer said gas explorers are sophisticated investors, and they can live with changes in price and market conditions. That was a caution that Anchorage Senator Hollis French picked up on.
He was careful to say these are necessary conditions, but not sufficient, meaning you could solve, Point Thompson, you could solve the fiscal issues and still be left with no project if the producers look long-term and don't see it as being economic, given supply issues worldwide.
There's been no indication of negotiations ongoing to settle the state-related issues. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A forum in downtown Anchorage today highlighted the need for a new look at multinational regulatory systems which deal with Arctic oil and gas development. Dr. Betsy Baker with the Vermont Law School Institute for Energy and the Environment addressed the Institute of the North as part of its Week of the Arctic program. Dr. Baker authored a paper focusing on U.S. and Canadian oil and gas regulations with an emphasis on how they compare with one another and how they line up with the Arctic Council's Arctic Offshore Oil and Gas Guidelines. Dr. Baker and her colleagues began their research into the differences in regulations before the disastrous Deepwater Horizon spill of last year.
The two regulatory bodies said, I don't know, 6 years ago now, we need to get together and just talk about our research needs every few years, just to share ideas that way. So the informal mechanisms are there, and maybe you stick with them. And what's really been helpful, people saying we're not so sure the formal route is the way to go, and we're not so sure harmonization is the way to go, that standards are being set and developed in a whole new light now since the Deepwater.
Dr. Baker is the lead on a white paper series which compares regulations for offshore development in Canada, Greenland, the U.S., and the Russian Federations. She says there's a number of areas in which the U.S. and Canada can coordinate or harmonize their regulations, but in other areas they have opposite approaches.
One difference between the two processes is that Canada's National Energy Board has a set timetable for its Arctic-specific review, while the U.S. DOI is more of an ongoing process. It continues to issue regulations, notices to lessees for all offshore activity, not just Arctic, even as it reviews its own Arctic procedures.
Dr. Baker says harmonization does not mean making all regulations identical, but aims to make selected rules on both sides of the U.S.-Canada boundary more uniform. Her paper is aimed at offering tools to regulators to help them identify which areas are the best candidates for harmonization. She says the role of industry standards is an important component in reaching more uniform oil and gas regulation, but that the U.S. and Canada have differing ways of incorporating those standards into a regulatory regime. The FBI has determined a white powder contained in packages sent to members of Alaska's congressional delegation was not a hazardous substance, but a sample of concrete material. Authorities say the offices of Alaska's two U.S. senators and congressmen had received suspicious packages through the mail on Monday, prompting the evacuation of the federal building in Fairbanks and the closure of the sixth floor of an Anchorage office building. At least two of the packages contained a white powder. It remained unclear today why the concrete mixture was mailed to the lawmakers' offices, but a statement from a baggage spokeswoman cited the FBI in saying the sender had no criminal intent. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, advice for berry pickers in the interior.
You're going to have to search a little bit more intensively for blueberries this time of year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The Supreme Court of Alaska has granted a motion by the state of Alaska for emergency review of the ballot initiative in the Lake and Peninsula Borough that would limit development of the Pebble Mine. The court is also allowing the state to participate in the proceedings as a friend of the court. KDLG's Dacia Eaton reports.
The decision means the briefs the state filed with the court concerning the case will be taken into consideration as the court makes its decision. The case revolves around whether the Lake and Peninsula Borough can move forward with a vote on a citizens' initiative aimed at adding language to the borough's permitting code to protect salmon and salmon habitat from development. If passed, the initiative could stop the Pebble Partnership from getting the permits it needs from the borough to move forward with the mine. The Save Our Salmon, or SOS, initiative was introduced by the citizen group Alaskans for Bristol Bay back in March. The Pebble Partnership took its case against the Lake and Peninsula Borough to the Supreme Court August 1st, appealing a lower court's decision to allow the initiative to go forward. Shortly thereafter, the administration of Alaska Governor Sean Parnell filed a motion to expedite the case with the court. In their filings, the Parnell administration stressed the state's interest in the case because of its potential impacts on the development of Alaska's mineral resources and the fact that it would set legal precedent for development on state land. The Pebble deposit is on state land. In addition, the court also granted the motion to participate as a friend of the court to the Bristol Bay-based Alaska Native Conservation Group, Nunumta Alukastai. Nunumta's filings support the Lake and Peninsula Borough and will also be taken into consideration by the court. A vote on the SOS initiative is set for October 4th. The Alaska Supreme Court is expected to rule on whether the vote can go forward any day now. In Dillingham, I'm Dacia Eaton.
The conflict between the state and federal government over National Park Service law enforcement on the Yukon River dates back to a regulatory change in 1996 at a forum on jurisdiction over navigable waters held in Fairbanks yesterday. State Attorney General John Burns cited the policy change as the root of recent tensions between the state and the Park Service.
In 1996, however, the Park Service amended its regulations to expand the applicability of its authority to include navigable waters, and this is important, the language, without regard to the ownership of submerged lands, tidelands, or lowlands.
Burns said the Park Service's expansion of authority in Alaska defies the U.S. and state constitutions, the Federal Submerged Lands Act, and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. The most publicly visible conflict between the state and the Park Service has been in the Yukon-Charley Rivers Preserve, where National Park rangers doing boat inspections handcuffed uncooperative locals on two occasions last year. Yukon-Charley Superintendent Greg Dudgeon said the authority to police boating within parks also stems from federal law.
That authority, of course, is found in the Property and Commerce Clause, but more specifically, I think, the Organic Act and 16 U.S.C., the regulation that has been brought up several times today already was not established. It was not revised. It was clarified in 96.
The state is seeking legal clarification on the issue of Park Service authority on Alaska's navigable waters. Yesterday's roundtable discussion was organized by Senator Lisa Murkowski. Murkowski says she'll be pressing for an answer when she returns to Washington next month.
The state has filed its documentation almost a year ago now and are still waiting for a response from the Department of Interior when it comes to this rulemaking. That's important to make sure that that is proceeding and hopefully that we get a favorable outcome from that.
Dudgeon and state officials stress that there's still a lot of cooperation between state and federal agencies when it comes to law enforcement. Powering rural Alaska is nothing if not complicated. You may think that wind energy would lower bills to residents who live in villages with turbines, but that's not entirely the case. As at KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports from Bethel, the alternative energy that many communities are pursuing is more about stabilizing costs for the long-term future.
The village of Chivak on the Bering Sea coast is the latest community in western Alaska to get a new energy plant that combines wind and diesel. Chivak's had four new wind turbines functioning for about a year.
The system as a whole looks real nice, and everybody in Chivak is pretty much pleased.
That's Ulrich Olrun, Chivak's mayor. He says all four wind turbines haven't run all the time because they've been working out initial glitches. Still, he says, the savings to their power utility has been substantial.
Chivak has saved about 50,000 gallons of diesel. Instead of using 50,000 gallons to run the plant, they've used wind power, so that's pretty good for, you know, trying to figure out the system.
The Alaska Village Electric Cooperative is a nonprofit electric utility for 53 villages in the state, mostly in western Alaska. Of those 53 communities, 16 are getting some kind of wind power. Some have turbines, and others are tied into neighboring villages that have them. There are about 35 wind turbines in total, which AVEC can remotely control. AVEC President Mira Kohler says how much diesel can be displaced in a community is determined by the local wind quality. With Chivak's Class 4 wind regime, AVEC expects to displace about 25% of its diesel fuel, which equals about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. But those savings will not be seen by most residents.
Their electric rate goes down, but the PCE rate also goes down at the same time.
PCE is the Power Cost Equalization Program funded by the state to subsidize high electrical rates in rural areas. Most residents and many nonprofits in rural Alaska qualify for PCE. So even though AVEC is saving fuel by using wind energy, in turn, they are getting less funding from the state. Kohler says the benefit to the average residential consumer is knowing that their electrical bill is remaining stable because they are less reliant on PCE.
PCE has been sort of a football that's been kicked around in the state legislature, and there have been many, many, many years where funding was not 100%. And so we have to visualize life beyond PCE.
But it's not all about savings down the road. Some in the village do see a direct result from wind. Commercial businesses, schools, and residents who use over 500 kilowatts per month do not qualify for the subsidy. And Kohler says they are the biggest energy users.
As a rule, if you look across the state, about two-thirds of the electricity that's sold in a PCE community doesn't get PCE. So it's those two-thirds of the kilowatt hours sold that see a major benefit.
As for Chivak's mayor, Olrun says he understands that wind energy is a long-term solution, and he's trying to help explain it to others.
It's pretty complicated, all right. It's a complicated system. Quite a few people in Chivak are still trying to understand it.
Chivak held a ribbon-cutting ceremony earlier this month for its new energy facility, which includes a new AVEC power plant, an AVEC tank farm, the four wind turbines, and the community tank farm, which are all working together. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
It's been a wet summer around the state, and if all the recent rain is getting you down, it might help to know the moisture is good for blueberries and cranberries in the interior. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Pat Holloway, director of the Jorgensen Botanical Gardens at UAF, says there's an upside to all the rain that's been falling around the interior this summer.
That rain that we had later on that everybody moans about, the rain actually improves the size of the berries.
Holloway says it's not just rain, but when it fell and when it didn't. She says a dry spell early in the season, along with a good midsummer rain and those over the past couple of weeks, combined to make it a good year for blueberries and cranberries.
The fruit yields have been pretty good, and so people are pretty satisfied. We've had some years that were just everything, all the hillsides are just blue, and it's not that stage, so it's not the very best that people have ever seen. But it's good.
That's unlike the situation in South Central and the Kenai Peninsula, where a species of moth has devastated blueberry bushes, severely reducing the yield in those parts. Holloway, who's also a professor of horticulture at UAF, says we haven't had that problem here in the interior.
We have not been hit by that and haven't seen any damage.
She says that's probably because we have a different type of blueberry here.
We have totally different species up here of blueberry. Ours is the bog blueberry, everybody calls it Vaccinium uliginosum is the scientific name. So it's different from the one that's on the coast. So they have a coastal blueberry, and, well, they got two, maybe three species that we don't have in the interior.
And there's no question as to which variety Holloway finds tastier.
The one on the coast tends to be a little bit sweeter and blander, and ours has by far the best flavor, no question about it.
Holloway also predicts a good cranberry season for the interior and possibly a very good highbush cranberry season. But it'll be a couple of weeks before lowbush cranberries are ready to be harvested, and most say the highbush variety is best harvested after the first frost. As for blueberries, Holloway says it's late in the season, so she says berry pickers will have to look around for some good patches.
Because it's toward the end of the season, you're going to have to go north and up. And so the higher elevations might have some fruit that are still mature, but most of the stuff in the lowlands is going to be either picked over or gone. So you're going to have to search a little bit more intensively for blueberries this time of year.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
An investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board is looking into the fatal plane crash that killed two people near McGrath. Clint Johnson says one of the four survivors told him the small aircraft struck the side of a mountain in fog so thick it created whiteout conditions. The plane crash also killed pilot Ernie Chase. Talkeetna resident Amanda Randalls knew Chase her whole life as a pilot and as a friend and has this remembrance.
I cuddled up with my 9-year-old last night, trying to process the death of my friend, Ernie Chase. I told my son that Ernie was the best of pilots, that I'd have flown with him anywhere. And I realized as I said it, I sort of did fly with him everywhere. Ernie was a fixture of my childhood, both on and off the ground. Life in rural Alaska means air travel, and more often than not, at least when I was younger, Ernie was the pilot that got us from village to village, or into town for appointments, or even on a fun vacation to Nome for the Iditarod finish when I was around 10. The first time I remember flying with him, I was 6. Mom and I were moving to Anvik. Mom and I, 2 cats, and a dog team. Ernie met us on the McGrath airstrip. He took a look at the wildly frolicking dog, muttered something about damage to his airplane, and whipped out the rural Alaskan's best friend, duct tape. I tried to help by holding the dog still while Ernie and Mom taped muzzles, front legs together, and back legs together. I doubt I was much help. The dogs all outweighed me. They stacked the dogs in the little Cessna like cordwood, and we headed out to Anvik. What followed was a squirrely, wiggling hour and 15 minutes. I remember ignoring the intense smell of many dogs in a small place and looking out the window at the fall colors on the Beaver Mountains, probably passing over the same place that Ernie died Saturday night, 31 years later. I remember it so vividly, the soft, rounded mountains in a patchwork of jewel tones, the small herd of caribou we passed, the shadow of our plane passing right over them. Beautiful country, still so wild. We crossed over the mountains and reached the Yukon River. I leaned forward and tapped Ernie on the shoulder with the obvious childhood question, "Are we there yet?" He told me Anvik was right in front of us. Didn't I see it? I looked and looked as he teased me. See, it's right there. Maybe you need glasses, yeah? And finally I saw it, a big hill with an airstrip on top like a reverse mohawk. You couldn't see the town from the Yukon side, and it seemed so odd, so out of place, to see anything man-made out there. In the time that we flew, our dogs had managed to work free of much of their bondage. We landed, and Ernie got out and threw open the doors. He was immediately overrun by a furry flood of dogs desperate to be free. Some had gotten back legs free, others their front legs. Almost all had gotten the tape off their muzzles. Suddenly, the Anvik airstrip was overrun with dogs energetically hopping about on various versions of three legs, celebrating their freedom with barks and howls and frenetic leaping. Ernie's brother Ken drove up to the airstrip to find the three of us madly chasing bouncing sled dogs in the afternoon sun. I spent my 7th birthday at Ernie's house in Grayling. The Anvik chases joined my family, minus the critters, and Ernie's for a large family Thanksgiving. We'd gotten a lot of snow, and that morning us kids all bundled up and proceeded to make tunnels all over the front yard. For my birthday, my mom presented me with a rabbit hat she'd made for me. Ernie then pulled me aside and solemnly told me that she had actually skinned my cat to make me that hat. I had a complete meltdown. The man had a wicked and silly sense of humor. The cat died a thankfully natural death many years later, but I still have that hat. Life is risky in rural Alaska. Even the best pilots can go down. Ernie was the best. I'm heartbroken that we lost such a great, fun man, but I'm thankful to have even known him. I've often thought of leaving Alaska, living in a place with less death, less heartbreak. But the reality is, the rest of the world doesn't make people like Ernie Chase. I could live in a safer place, raise my kids in a safer place, but I'll stay here, because the people of rural Alaska are like no one else in the world. God bless you, Ernie. I'll miss you. In Talkeetna, I'm Amanda Randles.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Amanda Randles in Talkeetna. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.